Bonsoir et bienvenue au Café scientifique de IRSC qui va aborder les tests génétiques et vous. The conversation this evening will be in English, but I started like this just to let you know that as the moderator, I can take questions in both languages. So if you want to ask a question in French, I can translate it to English for our panelists. So please feel free. Genetic testing, what a timely topic. Generally because genetics seems to be everywhere these days, and particularly tonight because exactly 10 years ago, 10 years and 4 days ago, the completion of the Human Genome Project was announced. For the first time in history, the entire human genome was sequenced, and at the time, a lot of world leaders took the opportunity to make big declarations. Clinton said to the media, "Today we're learning the language in which God created life." So what have we accomplished since then in the past decade? Well, some of that hype turned out to be exaggerated. For example, gene therapy did not take off. And as the current director of the Human Genome Research Institute at the NIH recently said, we have a long way to go to deliver on the promise of genomic medicine. But we're working hard and we are making progress, and over the last 10 years, thousands of mutations have been identified that are associated with diseases or with an increased risk of getting a disease. And we do live in a world today where genes are becoming a crucial medical tool. We're also living today a fascinating transition from the previous approach of testing for one gene at a time, looking in a targeted way for specific mutations, to looking at the entire genome in one take. This is called whole genome sequencing, and it's done with powerful new technologies. And we're fast approaching the integration of this knowledge of the entire genome into clinical care. It took about 7 years to complete the first sequence of the human genome, and the cost was about $1 billion. Today, it takes a day or two to do the same thing at a cost of $5,000 a decade later. And we're fast approaching the $1,000 mark. This may revolutionize medical care in the coming decade, or not. It's early days. But it definitely takes us one step closer to the scenario from the movie Gattaca, and if you haven't seen, I recommend, in which knowledge of a person's entire genome is used daily to make decisions for good and for bad. So, genetic testing and you. Is it good for you? Is it bad for you? What are the benefits? What are the risks? Should you do it? This is our topic tonight. And to introduce some of the issues we will be discussing, I decided to get personal and share with you my personal experience, and I think it may reflect the experiences of many of you here tonight. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer in her 50s, and her cousin with the same disease a few weeks later. This was no surprise because her mother, my grandma, died in her 40s from breast cancer, as well as her sisters. So considering this happy family tree, my mom's doctor suggested genetic testing for BRCA1 and 2, mutations that are associated with increased risk for breast cancer, as you all know. So what would be the advantage for my mom of testing? Well, a positive result would mean that she has future increased risk and would mean that she should probably get mammographies and MRIs even more often, or perhaps even push her to consider prophylactic mastectomy of the remaining healthy breast. It would give her perhaps a sense of control over her fate. You know, we live in a culture of knowledge is power, and sometimes putting a number on our risk gives us a certain sense of control. But it would also allow her to tell me, her daughter, that I should get tested to see if I have the same increased risk so that I can increase my surveillance for early detection. But interestingly, my mom walked around for a year with a note from her doctor in her purse. And it took her a year of reflection to come to the decision about the testing. And to me, that was a very interesting reflection of how difficult it is to take this decision. So what were her doubts? What were the risks? I think intuitively, the first thing that comes to mind is that it's difficult to communicate a bad result to family members, and especially to children. We have a sort of irrational genetic guilt, as if we're responsible for passing on bad genes. And the worse the disease, the worse the guilt. So when we're testing for things like Huntington's and cancer and Alzheimer's, This is difficult stuff to discuss with family members. On the other hand, if we get a good result, sometimes we experience survivor's guilt. My mom's BRCA results came back negative, and she was recovering from her cancer while her cousin was dying. So sometimes being the unaffected one in the family has its own price tag. So we have genetic guilt and genetic survivor's guilt, but we also have a fundamental difficulty understanding risk information. What does it mean to have a 60% increased risk of getting sick? How difficult is it to take a risk that's applied, that's supposed to describe the risk for a population and apply it to the individual? Because at the end of the day, for you, it's 50-50. You're either going to get sick or not. So this is a huge challenge for a lot of us, and as a result, it's a huge challenge for genetic counselors. What would be the legal implications of knowing that you have an increased risk of getting sick? Will you pay more insurance premium? Will this affect your prospective employment? These are issues that doctors often do not discuss with patients prior to testing, but these are important issues. And finally, since my mom's result was negative, she was proposed participation in a research study that would look for additional BRCA mutations. And such research often targets specific populations where the disease is more prevalent. For us, that was the Ashkenazi Jewish community that we come from. So in this case, would that label the entire community as carrying bad genes? Would that lead to stigma and perhaps even discrimination? These are some of the issues that we'll be addressing tonight, and we have a wonderful panel of experts from various areas. Most of this evening is about you, the audience. We're going to very soon open the floor and listen to your questions and your concerns, and we hope to have this opportunity to inform you. We also have a special surprise. After the experts present themselves, we're going to have a Canadian premiere of a play, and the playwright is here with us tonight, so this is going to be very exciting. This is a play that will introduce some of these issues. Without further ado, I'm going to ask my panelists to introduce themselves and tell us what type of expertise they bring here tonight so that you know which one of them to target with your questions and your concerns. We'll go by order.
Okay, thanks, Bernie. That was a terrific introduction. And yeah, I forgot. 10 years.
Hard to the day. Yeah, April 14th, 2003.
Oh, I'm embarrassed. I didn't know that. I guess I'm not much of an expert. So, I'm a law professor from the University of Alberta, and I've had the opportunity to work with a tremendous interdisciplinary team, and some of my colleagues, many of my colleagues are in the audience and on the stage. I have looked at things like genetic discrimination, looked at the evidence around things like does genetic information cause anxiety. I've had the opportunity to look at things like how genetic information is presented to the general public in the popular press, in popular culture. Are those representations accurate? We've had the opportunity to reflect on what type of regulation is needed for things like direct-to-consumer genetic testing. So we've been really lucky to be able to explore all these things. Now, you'll get a sense that I'm a skeptic. I'm a skeptic on both sides of the ledger. I'm a skeptic both about the benefits and also about the risks. So I try to look at the evidence and kind of distill what's going on. Now, in addition to that, I went to one of the direct-to-consumer companies and got my genes tested. Now, at the time I did it, it was kind of a unique thing, kind of special, but now everyone's doing it. So I'm curious, how many people in the audience have had their genes tested? Now, look at that, which in itself is remarkable. There's probably 8 of us. You know, that's, in fact, it's remarkable that that's happened. But I was able to, you know, through that process, again, kind of reflect on what that risk information means to me, what that risk information means to the healthcare system. So I'm really looking forward to tonight and to having the discussion with the panel.
Thanks very much. Great introduction. My name is Bev Heim-Myers. I am the CEO of the Huntington Society of Canada. I'm also the chair of the Coalition for Genetic Fairness. So I'm not on either side of the fence. I know what side of the fence I'm on. We believe the coalition is 21 organizations that are representing genetic diseases. And we are concerned about Canada's lack of protection of genetic information. So Canada is the only G8 country that does not have legislation to protect your genetic information. We totally support going forward with the Genome Project. We totally support the prevention that it may provide to us and inform us going forward. But we are the voice of individuals who are concerned about their genetic information not being used to their benefit, but perhaps being used to their detriment. And that's why I'm here tonight. And thank you very much for inviting me.
My name is Frank Zinatelli. I'm with the Canadian Life and Health Insurance Association. And that group is a trade association representing life and health insurers. Well, I don't know that I'm on any side, you know. I guess I'm on an evidence-based side of whatever, you know, whatever the facts show, okay? And in that context, we certainly support increased use, increased development in science because, really, we have to rely on that approach in order to make good decisions. But those decisions have to be evidence-based. I'm going to probably be the one that's going to be talking to you about boring things like insurance, right? But let me tell you what insurance is. I actually wrote down a definition because it's important. And you know, insurance is a contract to provide financial protection against unanticipated loss. Unanticipated is a key word there. Okay. So there are many types of insurance. There's life insurance, there's critical illness insurance, disability insurance, long-term care. So depending on what insurance, different tests may apply. But one great principle applies across the whole spectrum of insurance, okay? And that is the principle of equality of information. Let me tell you about that. Insurers will tell you what their promise is. They'll tell you what they'll give you at the end of, you know, at some period when some event that you are obtaining protection for happens. So a person dies, insurer tells you what will happen then, what the payout will be to your beneficiaries. We disclose that, we tell you everything about the contract. You want to know that before you buy any product, insurance certainly, but any product. So the other part of equality of information, though, is that while we give you that promise, we request that applicants tell us about them. We want to know, we want them to disclose information that is relevant and material to the risk. We want to know what level of risk they bring to the table. If you have a male like me, okay, I'm in my late 50s, okay. I happen to be lucky and don't have, type 2 diabetes, okay? But then there might be another fellow in the audience who's 59 years old, and he has type 2 diabetes. So I go to the insurer, that person goes to the insurer. What happens is that the insurance, on a fact-based basis, looks at that, assesses the risk, and you know what? They're going to find that the person with type 2 diabetes brings greater risk to the table, so they're going to charge a little bit more for the insurance. I may be standard, they may not be. Although with type 2 diabetes, we're probably both standard. So that is the difference, equality of information. Because of this need for equality of information, on contract for insurance is a contract of the utmost good faith. It's called that for a reason, and I won't be too much longer. Okay. So how do we ensure that there is this equality of information? On our side, we make great efforts to disclose properly at the point of sale. We disclose annually to individuals. We also, as part of our literacy efforts, are creating plain language documents. On our policies, we're putting bold-faced language so that consumers know exactly what they're getting. But we want and we need to make the proper risk assessment to know the material and relevant information so that we can properly assess the risk. That's how insurance works, because if we don't assess a person properly, okay, then somebody else is going to pay for it, and that's not fair to other policyholders. I'm going to stop there, and hopefully we'll get to discuss other details later on. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Gail Ouellette. and I'm a geneticist. I was a researcher in genetics, and I'm also a genetic counselor. But what I do now is I do genetic counseling nearly every day. I'm director of the Quebec Coalition of Orphan Diseases, Le Regroupement Québécois des Maladies Orphelines. Rare diseases, 80% of them are of genetic origin, so genetics is always there. So I represent the patient, and I represent also daily living or living with genetic diseases also. So not myself, but I mean seeing patients and families with hereditary disorders where you know what they're going through often. So I can say that I'm on both sides because as a genetic counselor and also medical geneticists, doctors in genetics also do genetic counseling, we always want to give all the information, be it the benefits and the risks. So we're always, we want to be really careful that when we give options for testing, the patients know what are the advantages and the disadvantages. So we do talk about things like confidentiality and privacy and insurance. But something I'd like to insist on is that there are also a lot of benefits from genetic testing. But, and I think that's what was shown in your personal story earlier, the important thing is informed consent, which means that everybody should have all the information and they decide for themselves. It's a personal decision. So we see, as a genetic counselor, we see the benefits, not only the risks, but as I say, the important thing is that the individuals get all the information and that they're able to decide by themselves without any pressure and according to their values and their life situation.
Thank you, Paul. Instead of starting the discussion right away, we decided to benefit from the fact that we have this unique opportunity to listen to a play. And I'm going to invite one of the writers to say a few words just to introduce it, and then I'll call the actors up. Karen?
Hi, thank you.
Is it on? Oh, hi. So I'm Karen Rothenberg. As mentioned, I wrote this play with a colleague of mine, Lynn Bush, in 2011. And it was the first in a series of plays that we've been writing, trying to explore the both personal and professional implications of introducing whole genome sequencing. And I'm not going to say much more than that, but I think it dovetails nicely with some of the provocative points that were made by the panelists. And then I understand after the play, we'll be taking a break, and then we'll come back and discuss it. Okay, so without further ado.
Thank you.
lots of reading, you know, because you're
listening. Yes.
We are not professional actors and actresses, and that's why we have our scripts in hand. We'll be reading out this play, which is, in fact, an invitation that any of you could read out this play.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact.
You have the opportunity now.
It's not that simple. Genomics research and the consent process. As the play commences, we find Bobby, Amy, Sam, and Ellen Friedman, originally from Scotland, in the pediatric genetic clinic with Dr. Hardy. Bobby is a 19-year-old with an autosomal recessive genetic disorder. His degenerative symptoms manifested several years ago and are of a similar nature to those beginning to affect his sister, Amy, age 16. Sam, the 9-year-old sibling, does not have the heritable condition. They all reside with Helen, their mom, who is an elementary school teacher. Their dad, Howie, lives in another town with his second wife and young son.
Well, I don't think I have to tell you what you folks are all too aware of. Both Bobby and Amy are clearly experiencing a decline in their health. Bobby more than Amy, since his symptoms started first.
Isn't there anything new that could be done? I'm always seeing stories in the newspapers about all sorts of tests and treatments being developed for genetic diseases.
You'll find some way to cure us, won't you, Dr. Hardy?
Why did I have to come? I'm not sick.
Well, in fact, the reason I gathered you all here today is that I have some good news. You now have a better chance to understand what's causing your disorder. And you can be part of a new study. That includes you too, Sam.
How can I help them if I don't have their bad gene?
We'll do anything you say, Dr. Hardy, as long as it's safe.
But there's little danger. Just requires a simple blood draw. It's for a new type of analysis called genome sequencing. We use this to help understand the causes of genetic disorders by looking at all the human genes we know about. I have consent forms for all of you to sign. Take them home and read them before signing.
Oh, I know I want this test. I'll sign up for it right now. I don't need to read anything.
Right. Another test is not going to help us. Don't be so trusting, Amy.
Don't be so cynical, Bobby.
But let me just explain it further. Doctors at several institutions are collaborating to further our understanding of genetic disease, and are especially interested in studying disorders with an adolescent onset that are known to have increased prevalence in the Ashkenazi population. Hopefully, we'll be able to learn more about Bobby and Amy's specific heritable defect to help them.
So are you saying that this test is not just about my family, but mostly about lots of Jewish teenagers with Jewish diseases?
Well, we'll be looking at several groups, including healthy siblings, too. I have 5 consent forms here for all of the members of your immediate family. And it's highly preferable for dad to participate and have the specimen taken, too.
Dr. Hardy, it may be difficult to include Howie.
Dad hates doctor stuff. And anything to do with sick people, that's why he left us.
I bet he'll do it when he hears it could cure us.
Bobby, Amy, Sam, and Mom have returned home from Dr. Hardy's office with an array of medical documents and consent forms.
After all these years with so few answers, finally there's some really powerful genetic technology.
Let's start reading the consent forms already.
I wouldn't be so rushed if I were you. We're too optimistic. I've been going through all sorts of genetic testing for years, longer than you have, Amy. Why do you think this is going to be any different?
Because Dr. Hardy's consent form says here, right here, we will use new techniques to read all of the genetic information in your cells that might cause a health problem if it contained a mistake. See, Dr. Hardy's new test will find our genetic mistakes.
You mean your genetic mistakes? Can I go to my friend's house now?
I wonder if they're doing all our DNA or just the part called whole exome. I read on the internet that exomes code for protein, and some doctor back east just used the whole exome test that helps save a baby.
Hey, I'll bet they look at our exome first. It's got to be cheaper, and then maybe they'll test all of our genes. And all I know is it says DNA tests can take years.
Oh, but we need to get our results sooner than that.
Yeah.
Just glancing at this, why are there so many warnings in this consent form?
Mom, did you hear me? Can I walk over and go and play with Danny's?
Okay, go play. I'll take care of your consent. Kids.
Oh, sorry.
Bobby,
You know, no wonder they need 7 pages to explain things. They think we should be happy because the whole world doesn't see our medical information. Listen to this. Researchers who have access to genetic information will take measures to maintain the confidentiality of your genetic information. But how much of a measure? A ton or a drop in the bucket?
There's going to be lots of people reading about us when they bluntly say, even investigators at other participating institutions may see your information if they consult with other researchers.
Yeah, so other than the janitor, everyone's going to know about us. And look at this paragraph. Breaches in confidentiality involving genetic information could impact future insurability, employability, or reproductive plans, or have a negative impact on family relationships, like we need that.
Well, what does that mean? Reproduction plans? Does that mean that it hurts my chances of having a baby?
I don't know. That's not something we need to be worried about right now, I hope. But this part about hurting family relationships, what happens if my sisters discover that our family's genetic information is known to so many people? They'll hate me for that.
Well, why do you care what they think? Remember, it's been years since you even spoke to any of your sisters. But do I have to worry that every boyfriend is going to know that I have bad genes?
Yeah, well, what about me? Is it going to hurt me from getting a job if I ever get better because of our screwed up DNA? Look at this. There may be a risk that genetic information obtained as a result of participation in research could be misused for discriminatory purposes.
Don't worry, Bobby. See, it says, however, state and federal laws provide some protections against genetic discrimination.
Yeah, and here it even warns us. The Federal Privacy Act allows release of some information from your medical record without your permission. And they include law enforcement. That's the cops saying...
Well, if you're not getting in trouble with the police, then there's no problem.
I'm not worried about the police. I'm worried about what you and Amy have. We don't want to sound ungrateful and risk losing our chance to get these tests. I don't earn enough to pay for them. And I wouldn't even know where else to go. Anyway, this may be our last hope.
Yeah, but they say here that they store samples indefinitely. That means everything about us goes into some federal data bank. Why? Forever?
No need to worry, Bobby. Didn't you read about everything being coded and locked up? The consent says all our information is password protected.
You've got to be kidding me. People hack into computer files all the time and crack codes.
Yeah, but they make sure to tell us how careful they are. Look, when results are reported in medical journals or at scientific meetings, study participants are not named and identified.
But if you read on, however, it may include your family history and other medical information. It is possible but unlikely that you and or a family member could be recognized. Grandma back in Aberdeen would be so upset if our family story was out there for others to know.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want the world to see that either. And what about Sam?
Oh, I've lost Sam. You know, I have another worry. This says we might get told what's wrong even if we don't want to know. Look, you will be given a choice to learn or not learn the results of your genome sequencing. The only exception to opting out is if we find a result that has urgent importance to your health. We plan to share this type of result with you.
Hi, I'm back. Danny had homework to do.
You know, the doctors don't say anywhere in all these pages about just how urgent or bad it has to be before they tell us this bad news. Does urgent importance mean you're going to die in a week?
Well, the form goes on to say, in the future, we may contact you to find out if you're interested in learning about your results or gene variants that are important to your health and or the health of your relatives.
I know. You know, they say important, but how will they decide what's really important enough to tell us?
So, Mom, how are you going to check this off? I would like to be contacted about the diagnosis, possible treatment, or genetic causes of my child's disorder, or please do not contact me regarding the progress of the study or any specific gene change you found.
why isn't there a checklist for us to say exactly which diseases we want to be told or which we really don't want to be told about?
You know, what if Amy wants to know everything and you don't? And it turns out both you guys have something like that BRCA1 gene you hear so much about. And what about Sam?
Don't worry about me. I'm the healthy kid in the family.
Of course I'd want to know everything. We'd all want to know.
Don't jump to conclusions, Amy. You can't speak for the whole family.
That's for sure.
Your dad and I are healthy. We obviously gave you something bad in our genes, but there's no need for us to know anything. And who knows if your dad will even show up to do his part of the test.
But how could you not want to know what's in your genes? That's so old-fashioned. Well, I checked off that I want to know all the results.
So did I, because I don't want the doctors knowing all about me if I don't know about me.
I would not want any of us to know if something bad is going to happen way into the future, like Alzheimer's or breast cancer. Why would they want to know ahead of time and worry?
I don't really need to hear this stuff. I'm going to go do my homework.
The consent form also said something about our relatives' learning results.
My relatives? Oh, I certainly wouldn't want my mother hearing about my results. And I wouldn't even know how to begin to tell my sister Rachel. And as for my sister Sarah, it's none of her business. If the doctors find something, I'll just keep it a secret.
A secret? You're horrible at keeping secrets, Mom.
That nice genetic counselor can always tell Aunt Rachel and Aunt Sarah.
They don't need to know anything. If my sisters are curious, they can get tested themselves.
Mom, just sign the paper and keep it simple, please.
It's not that simple.
Thank you to Stephanie Robertson, Jim Evans, Tanya Bubila, Brenda Wilson, and Danielle Kemmerer. Thank you very much for your attention. Aren't we all hungry and thirsty after this, before we start the conversation? Thank you.
Shall we start? Yeah, because it's after 8. Can...
Think about it. Family history is genetic.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you can do that, there goes the industry, basically. Because that's...
Your mics are on. We're going to start the exciting part of the evening, our open discussion. 2 points. The whole thing is being filmed, so if you could please ask your questions through the mic that is right there in the middle so that it can get your voice. Otherwise, I'll repeat your question. And second of all, there are evaluation forms on the chairs. If you could please complete one before leaving tonight, this is important because it helps us decide which topics to pursue in the future. So I'm opening the rest of the evening is all about your questions and concerns and informational needs. We may discuss the play, address specific questions to the various panelists, or even ask the actors to tell us how they felt while reading this. But I want to hear from you, so let's open this up. To launch the discussion, because everybody's so shy here, I know a lot of you and you're not so shy, I would like to ask the readers of our play to tell us what it felt like to be in the shoes of the patient, the family.
So should we go to my...
That would be better.
Okay.
And if you can tell us who you are in real life.
So my name is Jim Evans. I'm a medical geneticist. I actually have been involved with Karen a little bit in the past with the plays. And I find it... actually very valuable experience to be on the other side, kind of a role-playing, because I'm always on the other side of the interaction, right? So I think it does give some insight. I also wanted to just get a plug-in, because I'm really not on straddling the fence when it comes to certain types of genetic testing. And I did want to just get something when in your excellent discussion, one thing you didn't mention was ovarian cancer. When I'm talking to women about testing for BRCA1 or 2, that in many ways is what really drives the conversation. Because while breast cancer we're pretty good at picking up, at screening for, we are abysmal at that with ovarian cancer. And women with mutations in BRCA1 and 2 have a very, very high risk. And we can prevent that disease to a considerable extent through prophylactic oophorectomy after childbearing, after menopause. So I just wanted to get a plug in there for that.
Useful medical information. Thank you. Any other reader, actor, that would like to tell us how they felt participating? Where did they go? Sam?
Superpowered microphone. Can everybody hear me now? So my name is Adam Halpert. I work at McGill in the Institute for Integrated Management. I have a question for Frank. Now, I have life insurance and I have critical illness insurance, and I didn't apply for them that long ago, but it was before I did genetic testing, and I can't recall right now. Is it standard procedure to ask if someone's gone through genetic testing? I'll ask the second part of the question, which I think is for Beth. So we live in Canada, which I just learned doesn't have regulations about protecting information related to genetic testing. The service that I used was 23andMe, which is an American company. And so am I protected by the fact that the service I used was an American company or the fact that I'm Canadian? So I'm wondering how that works. And I'll sit down while you guys answer.
Do you want to go first with the first question?
Sure, maybe I'll start, and then you can add, and we can go back and forth a little bit. First of all, with respect to whether it is a basic question, to ask, have you had a genetic test? It totally depends. Likely not. There are various types of insurance, and I hate to do this, but I'm going to talk about insurance again. But there are various types of insurance, and we'll start at one end, and you have what's called group insurance, right? And you might have that through work. So what happens in group insurance is that you don't actually look at individuals. You look at the group. You look at the experience of the group. So you start working with an entity. You join the group. You don't get evaluated, assessed in any way. So there are no questions. There's no underwriting. You're covered, right? Okay, that's group insurance. Then, if we move along the spectrum a little bit, what you have is a whole bunch of kind of simplified types of insurance, which can get up to, some of them are simplified, but you can get coverage for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 even. And some of the questions are pretty basic questions and pretty few. So, if you have the opportunity to ask 7 or 8 questions, you're probably not going to focus on whether you've had a genetic test, because what you want to talk about is likely, more related to family history, your financial status, because, you have to be able to pay for the insurance, which is useful. Otherwise, we probably won't sell it to you if you can't pay for it, okay? That's part of your joke. But then you go along the spectrum further, and you get, policies that may be for a lot more money, okay? And so as policies get richer in the amount of payout, you ask more questions. And whether somebody asks about genetic testing, totally up to the company, whether they want to or not. Okay? If they figure that's important. Because different companies put emphasis on different factors. They have different risk appetites. They have different areas of the market that they focus on. So, do they ask? Probably in a rare situation, I would think. I would rather focus on more important questions. Before I turn it over to Beth, I'm sorry. I knew that. Because we've spoken last
time. That's okay.
Before.
Keep going.
Yeah. But I just want to say that there are indeed protections in Canada in different ways. They're not direct protections, but there are human rights codes which deal with, with for example, disability, et cetera. There's privacy codes. There are insurance acts across the country. Okay? There are insurance acts across the country, and insurance is one of the most regulated industries in the whole of Canada. In fact, if you look at our Federal Insurance Companies Act, it's the second largest statute which regulates us in federally. The only bigger one, if you want to guess, is the Income Tax Act. So beware. Okay. I'll leave it there, but I'll be happy to follow up.
So just addressing the protection, there is privacy protection in Canada for your personal information, but there's no legislation to protect your genetic information. So employers, insurance companies can use that information to make business decisions. That information, when provided, is not just for research or for health reasons. So that's a bit of a barrier for some folks going forward. So this isn't an answer to your question, but just to clarify a bit further. That's a barrier for some folks who are in the process of deciding whether or not they want to have genetic testing done. And our stance is it shouldn't be a barrier, because genetic testing can tell you a whole lot. Although, let's understand, it's not that predictive in many cases. So when it comes to monogenetic diseases, Huntington disease is a monogenetic disease. We know what where it lies in the genome. We know that if somebody has the mutation, in time they will die from the disease, seldom before they're 50 years of age, but in time they will. There's not many diseases like that, Tay-Sachs, CF. Other diseases, it's a probability. So it's your personal information. No one else should have access to that unless you want them to have access to it. So directly to your question, when you talk about 23andMe, that's a direct-to-consumer test. those tests are not regulated, and I think Tim referred to those earlier when he started talking. Those are direct-to-consumer tests that you can, genetic testing that you can get done for $100. I think now it's down, or maybe even less now, down to $100. So the risk in that is, just because it was done in the States doesn't necessarily protect you. If you get the test back and something is flagged in that test, let's say prostate cancer is flagged in the test, and it's all on numbers and it's all on your genealogy and your probability, but let's say that was flagged, and you took it to your family doctor, and you shared that information with the family doctor, right or not, because there's no regulation around direct-to-consumer testing, it's out of a clinical setting, who knows how accurate it is. You take it to your family doctor, now your family doctor knows. Now you go for insurance, and you sign on your insurance form that they can contact your family doctor, and the information your family doctor has to be shared with the insurance company. You give them permission to do that. And you've already given them the information that you've had a genetic test done, and this is the result of the genetic test. So that's where it would come into play. If you didn't tell anybody and you just kept that to yourself, I don't know how anybody could find out.
Tim
had something to add.
Okay.
By the way, Tim Caulfield.
Oh, I'm Tim Caulfield. I understand. I didn't mention my name. So I apologize. So, I would like to, I'm going to be a little provocative here. We're going to get some questions going. Bev and I have had the opportunity to cross.
Be on radio together.
Exactly, right? On this topic before. I'm going to say, look, why would an insurance company want your information, your genetic information, right? Unless it's a monogenetic disease, which they're going to know through family history, except for in rare circumstances, right? They're going to know through family history. Why are they going to want to know? They want to know your weight, right? They're going to want to know your blood pressure. They're going to ask you your family history. All of those things are far more predictive than most genetic tests, right? So should we have an anti-blood pressure law in Canada? I'll tell you, that has a lot more impact on your life. You can lose your insurance, or you get insurance rated on your blood pressure, am I right?
You probably are.
Yeah, okay. I got high blood pressure, so there you go. You could lose it on, you could, you know, your weight. Your
whether you'd be rated, it would just depend. Right?
Let's pretend I'm going to get rated.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, you can, your weight, your family history, those things are far more predictive than almost any genetic test you can get through direct-to-consumer testing. In addition to that, look, you have some things that you're at risk for, right? You were also at things that you were less risk for, right? So maybe it's going to play out in the aggregate. You're going to be rated the same, even if that information was valuable, right? So you know what? I don't think we need genetic discrimination laws. And in fact, you could argue, I'm being a little provocative here, you could argue they do social harm by essentializing genetics, by making genetics sound like it's special kind of information, more private than other kinds of health information. When in fact, you know, all health information should be treated the same. All kind of personal and sensitive information should be treated the same. And I think it should be all covered the same. And that's the way it should be treated. And you can almost do damage to the discourse by creating laws like GINA in the United States.
And all the other G8 countries.
Yeah, and all those other laws.
Or we wouldn't need laws in Canada if the insurance industry and employers agreed to a voluntary moratorium on using genetic information. Of course we wouldn't need laws, but they haven't. And the Genome Project has been in since, the Genome Project started in 1989. It's been a long time, and at that time, a lot of countries said, we need to protect this information because we have no idea where it's going. And it's personal information, it's complicated information, and what's it going to tell us? Well, until we know, people shouldn't be making decisions on this. So if we had that, quick comment.
I could comment on the G8 thing, but I see hands going up, so I'm...
we're talking about risks. It's an opportunity to go back to the benefits. If you have a family history like mine, and you come to your insurance company showing a negative genetic test result, this may actually improve your situation, because it shows that maybe it's not as bad as it looks from the family tree. So there's a twist on this point. Gail?
Yeah, I just want to tell about the clinical perspective that there may be risks, and they're out there, but I just want to reassure people that in genetics clinics, as any other health information, it's treated like confidential information. Now, your genetic testing results don't go out to anybody more than your blood pressure.
Right.
So I just want to reassure people that there's always problems in confidentiality in hospitals and clinics, maybe, but people are trained for keeping this confidential, and there are rules about giving out information. There are authorization forms. So I just want to reassure people that some people think that everything's out there. And one point I want to make is that maybe also stresses the fact that it's health information. We have a problem here in Quebec, and it's a huge problem. In our Charter of Rights and Liberties, like sexual orientation, gender, religion, there's not supposed to be discrimination towards disability, and that includes health problems. But we have in our system our hospitals and health services here in Quebec. They ask medical information in the pre-employment questionnaires. And I know I had to deal with that, and maybe other here who applied for jobs in the health system. And that's a basic right that's being discriminated here in Quebec by our hospital, our health system. And there are probably other companies doing this. So if they ask any medical question, be it genetic testing or whatever, that's discriminatory.
We're going to go back to the audience and take another question. Could you go to the mic, please? Or I can repeat it.
I'll go back. Okay. When my son's born, and I didn't give him insurance right away, and I didn't have it because I'm too poor in that period of time. Anyway, and after we learned he had the sickness of Fabry's, and I have it. When after I tried to apply to insurance, I don't know how you call that. And anyway, even in French, I don't remember the name, but the guy was working for insurance, but for many company, and he said, any of them want to put insurance on you or on your boy? And I was pissed off. I'm sorry. I was mad.
Okay, and I can understand. I can understand having had to make some adjustments on a policy that I was purchasing. I can understand how frustrating it can be when that occurs. But I just want to kind of go back a little bit and remind ourselves of what I said at the very beginning. You know, I said insurance is when you purchase financial securities for unanticipated losses. Well, unanticipated meaning that you don't know about it, okay? It's something that you don't know about it. If you know that the risk is there, you can't assure an existing risk. What people would say, another example that doesn't have to do with life insurance or health insurance would be fire insurance, okay? Like, you know, if a house is burning, you can't run to the insurance company and say, please insure my house, which is now burning. That's not the way it works.
Okay, I want to add something about that. Sorry for the camera. We cannot predict about fabric. I don't know how an insurance company, how they think, if they think all genetics problem or they take it one sickness by one sickness. Because about fabric, my godfather is dead. But when you have like 69, my mother's dead, but like 67. Mm-hmm. You understand what I mean? They're not dead before. They're not dead at 40 years, and that's why I was like, how they think about insurance? If they take like every sickness on the same level, or they can make la moyenne, the average of people's diet. I don't know, you know, I have a lot of imagination, you know, but I try to understand how they think about that.
Well, what I can tell you is that what insurers do, particularly when there is a fuller assessment of somebody that is applied for insurance, is they do an individualized assessment, okay? They look at that individual and at the particular situation for that individual. And they assess, they then assess on the basis of what they find, of the information that is made available to them, you know, what kind of risk, what level of risk they bring. And then they find other people that might have different conditions but have the same level of risk, okay? And then what they do is they put groups of people with the same level of risk, you know, over there. You know, you have the same, you have X risk, you go over there. You have Y level of risk, you go over there. You have Z, favorite letter of mine, Zinatelli, okay? You go over there. And then X, Y, and Z are charged a different price between groups, but within the same group, they are all treated equally because they bring the same level of risk to the table. So, but the assessment of a person is very much individualized to that particular person, and we have medical experts that know the latest science to be able to make those assessments.
Bev, and we're going to take another question. The challenge with this is that when decisions are made on genetic information, it's based on a perceived future disability. The information is not that predictive, so it's based on a perception. So our Human Rights Act that we've been referring to is based on disability, gender, and we have protections, but we don't have protections on our DNA, which who knows how predictive it is, yet decisions are being made based on the fact that it is predictive, and in many cases it is not. Your example was a great example, because in many diseases, even in Huntington disease, there is late onset Huntington disease. So even if you have the mutation, you may not get the disease until you're 75 years old. You may not become symptomatic. And in that time, over the time that your children have been young, that you've had a mortgage, that you needed protection, that's the time you need insurance for catastrophic events. But that's not taken into consideration. It's the first thing. If you're from a Huntington family, you cannot get life insurance. It's on the applications. So it doesn't take into consideration the late onset, when it's going to happen, and that does not make sense to me. And that's why a bill was presented to the Senate this week, hot off the press, by Senator Cowan to protect genetic information. And it still needs to go through other readings, but it is to actually have a non-discrimination act, add genetic characteristics to the labor code and to the Human Rights Act. So there's a lot of people that believe that we need to protect genetic information. We'll take another question just in case other people have. Alexandre?
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Alexandre Morin-Chassé from the University of Montreal, political science student. And I've had the occasion to study a little bit about everything that is related to public policy and genetics. And I was thinking to myself, for anyone who wants to move from a country to another, they're being asked questions about their health, and they're also asked to self-disclose information about whether or not there is inheritable diseases in their own family. And I was wondering if there is any law somewhere in the world that says that a government will not do a genetic testing to verify if someone has any predispositions to get a disease. And I was thinking to this because as we were speaking about 23andMe, this is becoming cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and it would become really easy to do that. But in the same time, it would be also possible to to take someone who says he has the genetic predispositions in his family and just to make sure that he is not discriminated against his own DNA, actually, which might not contain the predisposition, then it would be possible to use testing. So my way to think is whether it's good or not always depends on what we do with it. And I was wondering if there is any discussion here in Canada about having a legislation regarding immigration procedures and genetics.
So, genetic testing and immigration, who's going to take this up?
I don't have an answer for that. I do not know.
I'm not aware of any kind of discussion right now on that front. Certainly, look, we're just starting the genetic discrimination debate in Canada. So as far as I know, that hasn't really been on the horizon yet.
That's a good question, though, and I'll keep it in mind.
One thing that I've seen in the media, not in any academic literature, was in a case of a request to unite a family through immigration. There was a paternity DNA test done to see that the father and son who are requesting to be united are indeed related. So that's in the context of immigration, but a very particular case. But you've managed to challenge our experts with something that they don't know the answer to.
But can I just talk about a related thing, just harkening back? I don't know the answer to that one. I haven't heard of any such discussions. And I guess, you know, it's something that also Bev touched on. And that's the fact that you know, you look at the test and you look at the validity of the test. And that work is done. So, for example, Adam, I think it was, the test that you took, the validity of that would be like 0.0000001. Like, it would be so minute, a test like that, that it really would not play in the insurance context. As Tim was saying, there's much more important information that would be relevant. But our experts do look at the validity of these tests, and if, you know, if they're not valid, they toss them out.
Yes. Anybody else that waited longer?
Right there.
Yes.
Okay. A couple of things. I'm thinking if you're talking about validity, if you ask that lady, she'd have a completely different viewpoint on validity and that tiny number. Sarkissian from McGill. There's a couple of things I'm thinking about. One of it is I was born. I didn't ask to be born in the form that I'm born in. I should not have that information that you would find through a genetic test used against me or towards validating a premium in the same manner that my bad driving habits would, or my excellent ones. Accordingly, I think that there has to be really a very different way of looking at how we decide where the premium should be set. Potentially, if you're going to have a genetic test, maybe a little amount should be set away and provided to the company's insurances that would require covering for the patient. At that point, that which should be covered at that point, rather than taking the information that you get from the results and using those to determine how much you're going to charge them in a premium. With that said, I want to bring two examples of disastrous situations that have happened within my own lifetime. As a student, when I came here 20 years ago, I was asked by my boss, would you please give us some samples? And about 10 years afterwards, I had a graduate student running through the hallway with a piece of paper, shaking it, saying, Christina, we found a mutation in your gene. He knew exactly might happen to be a polymorphism. Wasn't very serious an issue at the time. There were very few laws against having this information out there. He shouldn't have had that information. By the same token, I was actually looking at some clinical data from clinical trials that had happened during the development of a drug I was working with. And because I knew the patient population, I knew exactly whose results they were. Their name wasn't there. I didn't even know by number who they were, but based on the location of where the test was done, the kind of information that was given, the level of their illness, I knew exactly where that information was, who it was about. Accordingly, a few years ago, I was actually in my doctor's office, and he, being a gossip, was telling me about a patient, happened to be my sister-in-law he was talking about. So this is the kind of information that's out there. And it will get eventually to the insurance company. And I don't think that you should be able to just use that information. Because if it's out there and my doctor is talking about it, there's a possibility it would get to you. And you shouldn't be able to use that information to hold it against me and raise my premium accordingly. you can respond to that in whatever way you wish.
I'm going to let Tim take it up first.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, this is a very interesting point. First of all, something that hasn't been said yet, there's been lots of research done around the world on whether there is genetic discrimination going on. Right? Lots of, you know what? There's almost no evidence anywhere that genetic discrimination is happening. Period. Now look, we have the HD one that went on, but that's HD, that's Yvonne's study. Completely different story. Completely different story. There's some research from Australia, very equivocal, right? Adam, if this was a disaster, you think that there'd be a strong signal that it's happening. It's a complex story. It's a complex story. Now, look, the other interesting thing that you raise is whether you're born with stuff. People say this. So genetic information is different because you're born with it, right? And you shouldn't be able to rate things because you're born with it. Look, you're born with your microbiome, right? So we should have an antimicrobiome legislation, right? And the other thing that's very predictive, this is data that just came out. I don't think it's going to hold, but research just came out that how much you exercise when you're a late teenager is very predictive of how much you're going to exercise over your life. That information is probably more powerful than any genetic information that we have, other than the monogenetic and the few highly penetrative cancer genes. So you know what we need? Anti-late-age exercise legislation, because that is highly predictive, right? So then you say, well, people are going to misinterpret this information, and genetic information is predictive of the future, and people are going to misinterpret it, and that's the problem. Well, we have no evidence compared to, say, whether there's more irrational future prediction going on with blood pressure or exercise or weight versus genetics. And the irony is, if we are having more kind of misinformation or misapplication of the risk associated with genetics, it's because of the hype around genetics. And having anti-genetic discrimination law is a self-fulfilling prophecy that creates more hype. You know what? This is pretty special information. I better, really watch it. So I think what we need to do is just start taking a deep breath, look at this information rationally. What is predictive? What's not? And base our law on the evidence available.
Bev and Frank, we took a deep breath when the Genome Project started. We took a deep breath then and said, this information, we don't know where it's going. We don't need to protect people. That's when the deep breath was taken. And now it's the rest of the story. There is genetic discrimination. We have lots of anecdotal, mind you, evidence with it. We also have research papers with Huntington. Other researchers have probably not done it. But I think that it's not fair to say it doesn't exist.
But Ben, many is it times, irrational discrimination? Like, is it discrimination that, that shouldn't...
Yes, it is irrational discrimination.
Exactly.
So, an example. A young man, Parkinson's. His father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. He went to get life insurance. He was denied because Parkinson's could be a genetic disease. We don't really know where it is.
Was it genetic testing?
He did not have a genetic test.
Family history.
His father had it, and he was denied insurance. The only way he could get it is to get a genetic test and prove he had no markers, but then that's not really predictive. So there is discrimination, and in many cases, people don't come forward with it, because there's a huge stigma attached to it. There's a stigma attached to discrimination. There's a stigma attached if you have a genetic disease in your family. People don't come forward. That's not right. People need to come forward, be quite comfortable having genetic tests so that if they do have a mutation, they can make the appropriate reproductive decisions, they can make the appropriate life decisions, they can plan their best life. What are we doing letting business tell people that they can't do that? We should remove that barrier. Brian?
Well, insurers have a job. Their job is to provide financial security to applicants who come to them and apply to get insurance. In that context, insurers, for example, let's take life insurance, they got one shot at it, okay? A 20-year-old comes along and applies for insurance. Okay. The insurer has to look at them very closely at that point in time and make an assessment as to the level of risk and what the future risk of that person is, like maybe 50 years down the road or 30 years down the road, because that's their only chance. They have to look at it. Our industry is a long-term industry. and the protection that we promise to give at that point in time is going to last forever. If we issue an insurance policy this year to an individual, to this lady here at the front here, okay? And then, like, tomorrow you find out, you know, something catastrophic about, I don't know, your family history, your genes, whatever. Well, you know, tough on us. We have that risk, and we're gonna stick with that promise because we can't go back. We have one chance to make that assessment, and that's why we are careful. We do it right. We're careful. We want, this is the other thing, we want to sell. The insurance industry is there to sell insurance. We're not trying not to sell insurance. We're trying to sell it because the industry doesn't work if we don't sell insurance. Indeed, 92 or so percent of people get insurance on a standard rate. About 3 or 4, 5% get it on a slightly higher price, and then some of them you can't get it. But it's competitive industry. Shop around. You'd be surprised the differences that you will find from one company to the other, because different companies have different risk tolerances, because different companies have different areas in which they specialize.
Last brief comment.
Just really quickly for an awareness for everybody here, and Frank's very aware of this. The Federal Privacy Commissioner's Office has looked at this from a privacy issue, and the question they ask is it appropriate for insurance companies to ask for genetic information? So to inform their decision-making process, they commissioned two papers to look at the economic impact on the insurance industry if they were not allowed to use genetic information in making their decisions. At this point in time, there is no significant economic impact from the impact and from an actuarial perspective. So the papers, that's what they showed. Now, these were only published in late fall last year, so these are hot off the press. So there won't be an economic impact at this point in time because there's very few monogenetic diseases, and the rest is predictive. So if it could be across the board, a voluntary moratorium, not to use genetic characteristics, that could be considered. But it will not have an impact on the industry economically based on those papers.
Thank you. Danielle?
Well, I would like to pick up on that actually with Tim, because I'm kind of intrigued by the fact that I'm Danielle, I'm Dr. Hardy, working for Genome Quebec. You're saying that basically legislation is not necessary in Canada. So,
or anywhere.
Well, or that anything else like high blood pressure or anything is more predictive. So we are all part of this genomics enterprise to like push the sequencing. And I mean, in the hope that one day this will actually serve and be maybe more informative than a blood pressure test or whatever. So, I mean, legislation is maybe... Well, I agree. A lot of the tests we do direct to consumer, it's almost like a game. I mean, it's what's the repercussions really? Not there are none. Not well, almost
minor.
Yeah, minor. Well, we are now. But what about 10 years from now? I mean, we're working on this project, right? Like it's supposed to go to go further. So, and legislation. It would be great if you could put legislation in place before.
It's a great point, right? You're asking the wrong guy because I'm a skeptic. I said, I actually don't think, and to be honest with you, most of the research, and Jim can talk about this, most of the research is signaling the other direction, right? That all of these things are incredibly complicated, right? That the genes are interacting with the environment and all these other things and epigenetics and, we've got ENCODE now. It's like, if anything, things are getting more complicated, not more simple, not more clearly predictive, right? And I do think that genetic information, personalized medicine is going to happen, and it's going to happen. I think we're going to stratify patients. I do think pharmacogenetics is going to get better. It's not going to be as promised, but it's going to get better. And I'm very pessimistic about things like we're going to have this risk information that is going to allow us to adjust our lifestyle, right? You know, it's just not going to happen. People who have heart attacks with scars down the middle of their chest, they wake up in the morning, see the scar, and they still eat fried food, smoke, and don't exercise, right? So, you know, and the other interesting thing, go back to this point, is, you know, this study that just came out just days ago about late life exercising, that's, you know, it really, I thought that was fascinating because that really goes to also the continuum of the role of genetics in our lives. I bet that's a predictor of someone's genetic predisposition not to exercise, right? So that's a genetic story too, right? It's I think genes and the environment interact in a very complicated way. Now, the interesting thing is, let's say it does become highly predictive. That becomes a very fascinating policy choice, because then you're saying, you know what, this is highly predictive, then the insurance company, you're going to hate this, should be able to use it. Because that's what insurance companies do. They discriminate based on highly predictive bits of information. That's what's so interesting about HD. Like, of course an insurance company should be able to use HD as a lawyer. I know this sounds horrible, but it's true. I mean, the Supreme Court has said you can use that information. That's what they do. That's what insurance companies do. They discriminate. What you want to stop is irrational discrimination, and there's no evidence that I think it's really happening right now.
I actually like to use the word differentiate, because discrimination has this negative connotation. And of course, if you look at the meaning of the word, the discriminate is simple. I discriminate every morning when I decide whether I'm going to have, oh my God, I shouldn't tell you this, Tim, a muffin or a croissant. You know, I'm discriminating, but that's obviously.
Carmela?
Okay. Hi. My name is Carmela, and I'm from Montreal, unemployment, semi-pensioner. I was always curious to get my genome picture out to predict what I might prevent, because my lifelong dream was always prevention. And now I'm getting confused. I have a feeling it's better I didn't do it. Although a friend of mine has a shop in Ottawa, if anyone is interested, beside Facebook, you can hang your genome on the wall. He's doing pictures out of on Bayward Market. And so people do put information out. What is hurting in this story of genome is hurting something else I'm very passionate about. And the passion I have is to have knowledge about clinical trials out, so people don't get wrong drugs, doctors don't prescribe wrong drugs, people don't die because of wrong drugs. And everybody's hiding behind privacy protection because in genetic area it was misused. So that's one concern I have. But I would like to have a question to the last person of the panel, because it must be some reason why they invited you to the panel. And nobody asks you any questions. So you did mention that, of course, everything is confidential, but I would like to understand what people get from such counseling. What is positive in genetic counseling, after all?
Actually, I knew probably I'd speak less because I was afraid that we didn't talk enough about the benefits of genetic testing. But I think that point was brought also. You have to discriminate between different kinds of genetic testing. And when we're talking about direct-to-consumer testing for common disorders, and they give some risks, it's not the same things that we do in clinic. What we do in clinic is mostly monogenic diseases, and where it's sometimes uncertain, and sometimes we know the outcome. So it could be beneficial to people use it to know if they're carriers of a disorder. So basically, to answer your question, we give all the information about the hereditary transmission and the different options of testing, for carrier testing, for prenatal diagnosis, for pre-symptomatic testing. So some people want answers for hereditary disease in their family. Am I a carrier? And that doesn't mean they'll have a disease. There are some forms of hereditary transmission where you're a carrier and you don't have the disease, but if your spouse, your partner has, you can have a child with a hereditary disease. So it's used for reproductive decisions. It's used when problems arise during pregnancy, where you can do some testing to confirm a diagnosis. And so it's there are some benefits.
Could I comment? Oh, sorry.
We don't have a lot of time left, and yeah, I want to hear
just
more
to
questions.
Say, I thought she was going to get the most questions, because after I saw the play and all the ethical questions you know, that arose from the play. I thought she was going to get the most questions.
Well, it seems people are concerned about insurance, Frank.
So, Stuart Hogarth from King's College London, and I do actually have a question for Gail, which is around the importance of pre- and post-test counselling in the provision of genetic testing. And I'd be interested to get your reactions to the very recently issued ACMG guideline on incidental findings. The ACMG just produced a guideline that I think is fairly extraordinary that said if you're going to have a genetic test and it's going to be done by whole genome sequencing, as well as having reported back the clinical question that you came to the doctor for, whether it's Huntington's or BRCA or whatever, there's about, we're going to give a list of a whole other thing, a lot of other things that we're going to report back as well, and we're not going to give you a choice about whether you get those things reported back. And certainly talking to colleagues in the UK who are geneticists about this, they're quite aghast at this guidance, and I'd be very interested to get your reaction.
This was highlighted beautifully in the play when they discussed their options on the consent form. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think I'm still digesting that those recommendations, and I'm not sure, and I think I haven't discussed it enough at my college, so I'm not sure I can give you the point of view that would be shared by everybody, but it is... one thing, you know, there's a lot of, there was this play that was, it's a subject that's been discussed a lot in the last years and in the last genetic meetings in the, a year and a half ago, the International Genetics Meeting in Montreal was this big plenary session on ethical issues of these testing genome sequencing and the impact on medical care and genetics. And the room was full, and it's really getting a lot of attention. And so there's a lot of studies, and some have been done here at McGill on incidental findings. And I think, and at one point it was any incidental finding, and there's all these predictive things, risks that you really can't be precise with. That I'm not sure it's a good thing to give. And but if you it brings up the question of giving the choice. And it's true. In my experience of clinical genetic counseling, we do for BRCA1 and 2, and for other, we do pre counseling, and people have the choice for their testing. Usually, for some of the disorders that are, there are, I think, 57 disorders in that table. And some of those disorders, I guess most of the time people would know that there are risks for that. They probably would want the test because there is surveillance. It's only disorders where there is surveillance or treatment or management. It's not disorders where you get the answer and you're just left out there in the blue and there's nothing to do. So they were selected for some... but what I would say, all these questions about, like, the play was touching on incidental findings, those would be the good ones to give people a choice, I think. And to tell you the truth, I'm not, I think, at this point, to say that they should be compulsory, I mean, that they have to give them out. And the way I was thinking also when I was thinking about this is, are there situations outside of genetics where there are some incidental findings like that? And there are. Every day. There's something that was telling me that maybe people should be informed of these things, because I think it happens for other things that we, not just genetics. And that brings again the idea that sometimes we just have to stop thinking that genetic results are so different all the time.
Yeah. We are seriously running out of time, and I hope we can hear two more questions.
I'm lucky. Bonsoir, donc, mon nom c'est Hubert Cornier, j'étudie au doctorat à l'Université Laval en nutrigénomique. Donc aujourd'hui on a abordé beaucoup les tests diagnostiques Il y a deux types, dans le fond, vraiment de tests DTC, Direct to Consumer. Ce que j'aurais aimé savoir, c'est qu'on peut avoir des tests qui sont vraiment diagnostiques, des tests qui sont plus préventifs, en fait, comme en nutrigénomique, par exemple. Les principaux problèmes de santé actuellement, tu sais, on note principalement l'obésité. On voudrait agir en prévention pour, dans le fond, épargner des coûts futurs. Dans le domaine de la santé, j'aimerais savoir un peu votre avis sur les tests plus préventifs, les tests qui préviendraient l'apparition de futures maladies, par exemple en améliorant son alimentation, comme les tests de nutrigénomique.
So now I'm in trouble. I told you I would translate this into English.
So, I got 2%.
To recap, the question is in the domain of nutrigenomics. What kinds of preventive tests do we have today that can tell us more about preventive measures in the context of obesity and how our nutrition today can prevent disease in the future?
Okay.
I hope I've done a little bit of justice to your question.
I hope you don't mind me answering in English because that's the only option I have. So I'm from Alberta. Yeah. Look, this is I love this topic, so I'm glad you asked this question. The answer is nothing. look, when I got my test done, 23andMe, which is really impressive, I don't want to slag them because they have a beautiful presentation, it's really fun. But if you look at their advice on what you should be doing to prevent disease, they tell you don't smoke, exercise, eat lots of fruits and vegetables, drink in moderation, and keep your weight down. For all of the risks, you know what, we're all supposed to be doing that. Now, a study just came out from the United States where they were doing an analysis of healthy behavior. And I actually think this is generous, but they said that 4% of Americans get enough exercise or even close to enough exercise, eat properly, and are trying. And this is just trying to keep their weight down, 4%. I think it's a joke that we're worried about modifying our eating habits according to our genome. When we aren't even close, when we get to 90% of the population eating enough fruits and vegetables, we'll worry about modifying it based on what we want. Okay?
I like that. Last question from you.
Yeah, I just had two quick comments. One rather prosaic, and that is for those of you who have had your direct-to-consumer genomic test, your 23andMe, don't take it too seriously, because had you sent it to another company, you'd have gotten wildly different results. The fact is, we don't know how to aggregate common risk SNPs into probabilistic estimates that are reliable. We simply don't, and you can prove that by sending the same sample to several different companies in which you will be found to be at high risk, medium risk, and low risk for the same disease. The other comment I'd make is in response to Tim's rather startling comment to me, that it was fine, I think this is what you said, to discriminate against people who have, for example, a Huntington's mutation. Now, what I'm saying...
Is that me?
Are you talking about health insurance?
No, life insurance.
I'm talking about life insurance. Now, we're in Canada. You're from the United States. We have a health system.
What I want to make sure to get across is that I perhaps legally it's fine to say, you know what, poor people have a higher chance of dying sooner. That's definitely true. People with a Huntington's mutation have a higher chance of dying sooner. Tough. Okay, we should discriminate against them. I don't want to live in a society like that. I don't want to live in a society that people, through absolutely no fault of their own, who have been born with a profound disadvantage in life, are that disadvantage is magnified by our policies and our legislation.
Okay, let me be very clear. Yeah. I was talking about insurance and how insurance works. Jim, if we're going to say you can't use this HD test, but you can use blood pressure, you can use...
Can you use the fact that somebody is poor? Because if you're poor, you definitely...
The insurance companies don't do that. Hey, but
they don't...
Where do you pick...
Do we want to live in a society like that, or do we want to live in a society where we all...
One option...
That? And, of course, I'm from the U.S. saying this, which is very ironic,
Look, there are... you know, we agree. So there are a whole bunch of things that are unfair to discriminate based on, right? So one thing you can say is, and some people propose this, and I actually like this idea, is there is a base rate of insurance that everyone's entitled to.
Right.
Right? Right. Because then you're not picking...
Solution, I completely agree. I don't think we should differentiate between exercising when you're 18 and that level and your genetic predisposition.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of bad reasons to discriminate right. that doesn't feel right, right? Whether it's HD, whether it's
you're
poor.
Let's not engage in genetic exceptionalism in the sense that we say that's the one that we
exactly
should
right.
discriminate against and the others we shouldn't, right? You
know? Right. No, exactly right. Like, and we shouldn't engage in it... Exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
Both sides of the story are true.
Jim and Tim, it's not that I don't enjoy seeing you fight. I do. But just to clarify the debate here to our audience, for example, in the UK, if you have the mutation for Huntington, you do not have to disclose it to your insurance company up to the amount of £500,000.
Right. Yes.
If you want to purchase life insurance beyond £500,000, then your insurance company is entitled to know. So we can argue over the amount, but that is the principle offered here.
Different market, different circumstances that have to be taken into account. Shorter term contracts in the UK, lots of differences that make
but
for
we may
different
agree on
policy,
the principle.
That make for different mm-hmm. policy decisions.
Last word to our playwright, Karen.
Oh, I just wanted maybe a theme that everybody spoke about. In whether when we talk about genetic or genomic information, is that it's not just about me making a decision about whether I want information. It has much greater implications. And you all know that. But if I decide I want something and my sister doesn't want it or my mother doesn't want it, it's a little bit different. The paradigm is different. And informed consent as we know it has to be reevaluated in that situation. And I'm not making an exceptionalism necessary argument, but I do think that you could say blood pressure is genetic as well. But generally speaking, I think one of the push for having this additional protection is that if I make a decision I want information, it could have a negative impact on other people in my family too. And maybe that's a public policy rationale for being a little bit more intentional about it. So it's just food for thought.
So what I propose to do is give 1 minute to each of our panelists to respond to Karen's last comment or any other point that they want to make to conclude the evening. Gail?
Well,
this is your chance to sell your product.
No, finally, I guess I did. But I just want... I think I want to reassure that most of the time when we, in clinic, when we discuss the hereditary disorders, and I'll exclude the late onset disorders like Huntington, most of the time it's insurance issues, privacy, confidentiality, that doesn't really come up. I mean, some people ask questions, but... It's I think most of the time people see how beneficial it is for them, you know, to have the testing. And I want to insist again that it's a personal decision, even though there's impact on other people in the family, it's a personal decision. There are some issues for other types of disorders, like the late onset disorders, and I want to insist that these predictive testing, it's not what we do in clinic in genetics. And I remember 10, 15 years ago, we had a government official who came to our clinic to evaluate the services, and they said, you know, you're going to have to prepare for these things, all these common disorders. I worked in research to find genes for common complex disorders, and 15, 20 years after these disorders, we don't have one gene or even just a couple. And so they told us to prepare for this and all these complex risks and things, but it's not what we do in clinic, and I think it's not an issue anymore for the question of insurance.
Thank you. Frank, 1 minute.
Okay.
We're over time.
First, I'll spend 5 seconds to say in Canada, we do have strong privacy legislation. So some of the issues that, the lady there mentioned, you know, you certainly on the insurance side, there's scrupulous rules. We can't share without consent and all that, even amongst family members. You know? Okay, so what the pitch I want to make, or the point I want to make, is that forums like these are good opportunities to have a discussion. You know, we're prepared at any time to sit around a table and discuss these issues so that we come up with, you know, relevant ways, good ways of addressing these important issues. And let's remember who our all-important client is, your client, our consumer, our policyholders. We're the same, you know, people that have to use the health system. Let's all work collaboratively to make it work for those people. That's what I think we want to do at the end of the day, and we as an industry are prepared anytime to participate in that, because we don't want the type of legislation that was introduced just yesterday that doesn't make sense and that would in fact prohibit us from using family history at all, which is the basis of the industry. It just doesn't make sense.
Thank you. Bev? A federal opinion poll was done not too long ago, and 91% of the Canadian population believe that business should not have access to your genetic information. So public opinion flies in the face of what's actually being done. When you talk about the tests, not only for your sister or your daughter, but for generations to come. So when genomes, if we're in the genome project, it's great because we need many people to involve themselves in that so that we have a lot of genomes so that we can come up with the answers. But if those genomes are seen, it is for generations to come, and it's time to protect that information. Last point, the legislation that's on the table does that. If you want insurance up to a certain point, genetic information, it's recommending that genetic information not be used. However, if you're going for the big policy and you're wanting to get more insurance, so it's a two-tiered, genetic information then can be used. So it is much more like the European model or the UK model, where it's the two-tier. Insurance is part of our social well-being in our society. And it's not right to use the genetic information for business decisions. Let's use it for what it should be used for health and for research, to help prevent disease, help you lead the best life you can. And let's face it, all Canadians are at risk with this because we all have mutations in our genome.
Thank you, Beth. Tim.
So I'm going to end by talking about the hype, and that's what you talked about at the very beginning. I just wrote a piece with some colleagues where we argued that a lot of the concerns that have been associated with the genetic revolution have really not panned out to be as severe as originally anticipated. Whether it's genetic discrimination, whether it's gene patenting, whether it's the anxiety, everyone thought people were going to freak out when they got their test results, and that hasn't panned out either. And I think it's because it's the genetic information itself has turned out to be much more complex, much more nuanced than we anticipated, not as predictive, not as powerful as originally envisioned. So both sides of the equation, the benefits and the risks, are much more nuanced, much more complicated than anticipated. Regression to the mean, that should be no surprise at all. And what I think is a lot of the discussion around genetic discrimination, and gene patents for that matter, are still living in the era of hype. And a lot of the G8 laws emerged in that time of hype. We're going to have these highly penetrant genes, and they're going to be tremendously predictive. That hasn't panned out. I think we need to base our laws on rational, evidence-based decision-making.
And my last sentence will be, whether it's counseling, privacy, insurance, relationships, hype, it's just not that simple. Thank you, everybody.